Senate Finance Committee will come to order. Good morning, members. It's Tuesday, March 8th, 2022. And we have a very special guest with us in person. Thank you so much, Commissioner Showalter, for being here. And you know, I kind of forced my banana bread on you, but thank you for indulging. There's more back here if anybody wants some. Yes, the sheriff wants to know where the coffee and banana bread is.
No donuts.
So welcome. Thank you very much, Commissioner. We need to talk about the February forecast.
Thank you.
We have a slide deck, I believe, that has been sent out and before you.
Thank you, Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me today is Dr. Laura Kalambakidis and State Budget Director Anna Mingi. And so together, we're going to present the February forecast and the information that's included in it. You know, over the past weeks, you know, it has been a roller coaster putting together this information. What we basically found is that there is an unpredictability and a certain humbleness that comes with presenting a forecast. You know, as we were putting together the information, we realized that just in the previous weeks, we'd gotten our national economic forecast from our consultants, IHS Markit. And at that point, they put together a comprehensive, detailed estimate of what's happening with the U.S. and world economy, which we base a Minnesota economy. It is a tradition and a pattern of getting more specific till we are able to produce the detailed forecast. But just days before we were about to release the forecast, we realized, that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was not part of that forecast. Things keep changing, the world keeps moving, and those kinds of significant risks and uncertainties, you know, are part of that forecast snapshot that we're never quite sure what's going to happen next. And hopefully, you know, we gather all of that information and pull it together in a cohesive way. But that was just one of those examples of how the last couple of years of uncertainty continues rolling forward. I would note that after we released the forecast, that uncertainty continued rumbling forward, that we found out that there was a technical error in one of the models basically associated with the revenue estimates. And so as a result, and as I've sent a note to you, Chair Rosen, and a number of other legislators, there is a technical error built into that revenue estimate that overestimates a portion of that revenue on in the current buying, but particularly in the out years. So there's always going to be sort of new information and surprises, but the function of this forecast that we're going to roll through right now is really a snapshot. We take together all the information we can have at that point in time and give you a balanced view, hopefully not overemphasizing the upsides or overemphasizing the downside, but giving everyone a snapshot of what we're expecting in the economy and the revenue picture and the spending picture, so that with more information for the rest of the session, you've got something as a baseline and as a starting point to make decisions and use judgment as to whether to be more optimistic or less optimistic before final enactment. So with that, we're going to take the next slide and look at some of the key elements of this forecast. As it says here, there's a forecast improvement of $1.5 billion in 22 and 23. Changes are mostly one-time. The projected surplus, that $1.5 billion, is added to the November forecast and anticipated balance at that point. So we're now at a total of $9.3 billion. The story and the drivers behind this forecast are very similar to what we saw in November. Increased economic activity associated with higher income, consumer spending, and corporate profits. That leads to improvements in our revenue estimates. And as I mentioned earlier, there continues to be significant question marks about the geopolitical and world economy. I think we're all well aware of inflation and the questions about how long or enduring that's going to be. And those are major factors that our economists are going to continue to monitor as we go forward. The next slide gives you just a quick look at the numbers view of that same story. What you see here is we started with the beginning balance of $7 billion. Revenues increased by $1.3 billion. So most of the change that we're talking about here in this forecast is on the revenue side. Spending change is also improves, so it helps the bottom line. There's less spending of $270 million. And unlike the November forecast, there is no trigger mechanism for putting additional funds into the reserve. So as a result, the budget reserve remains the same. The cash flow account remains the same. The only thing that does change is the stadium reserve, which, as you know, is just a dedicated account associated with charitable gaming. So budgetary balance, you see, has moved from $7.7 billion to $9.25 billion, or a change of $1.5 billion. That sort of concludes the introductory remarks, Chair. And if you're okay, I will turn it over to Dr. Kalambakidis.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do we have any questions for the Commissioner? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple real quick questions. Can you tell me how much is in reserve as well as how much is, cash flow or rainy day that we have in our budget?
And Senator Ingebrigtsen, Commissioner, could you go through the formula, how we come to that budget reserve amount for everybody's?
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair Rosen, Senator, the number of, I should commend to everyone, just a brief commercial. The full document of the forecasted book is always available. Plenty of numbers in there, and that's where I'm getting the number directly. Budget reserve is $2.656 billion at this point in time. The cash flow account is another $350 million. The cash flow account actually has been in statute for a long time. It just has been basically at $350 million. The budget reserve is set by estimates that is prepared by Dr. Kalambakidis and her team. And it really looks at a kind of a retrospective risk of what's the variation that we're seeing in our budget and our revenues. And so with that information, by statute, we kind of set the upper ceiling of that budget reserve. So that number actually fluctuates over time, depending on those estimates that come to the legislature.
What is the funding formula on that? Or Mr. Nauman, could you fill in the blank there, please?
Madam Chair, members, sorry, there's making sure I've got the technology working this morning. There's two pieces of formula. There's an amount in statute that if there is a positive balance in either a February or a November forecast, if the budgetary amount, if the reserve is below that level, and I think it's set at about 2.3 right now, I want to double check that. I might be wrong. The commissioner's giving me a funny.
No, I'm not.
I'll double check that. I wasn't prepared for that exact answer. But if the budget reserve is beneath that level, then 100% of any budgetary balance that's projected in a forecast goes to the reserve until it reaches that level. And once it exceeds that, and assuming other factors in the statute are also satisfied, mostly K-12 shifts and a variety of other things, any balance after that is triggered by the analysis prepared by the state economist. And 33% of any balance at that point, and that's only for a November forecast, would then be added to the budget reserve until it reaches the level recommended by Dr. Kalambakidis.
So that balance has already been in place because of the November forecast. The reserve increased.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Yes.
And Chair Rosen, if you like, State Budget Director Amenghi can also comment on it if you'd like.
That's a great idea, too. Yeah. And do you remember when the cash flow account was put into place? What year? And it's been a long time.
Yeah.
1988, something like that? It's been a long time. Okay. Well, we can find that out, too. Okay. Institutional knowledge is amazing. Any further questions? Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Hello, Commissioner. Good to see you. The question I have for you is on that, it says here you have a reduction in spending. Can you tell me, there's kind of a general sense of reduced spending. Mm-hmm. Education, I would suppose, healthcare maybe. Is in the education, is that per pupil? Is that how you measure the reduction in spending in education?
Commissioner.
Chair, Senator, great question. And Budget Director Amenghi is going to go into that in more detail further in the presentation. But you're right. It is really two different pieces contributing to that savings number, pretty much split between education and health and human mm-hmm. services. On the education side, there's some decline in the number of pupils because of the formula and the way the spending works. That means fewer dollars overall. And on the Health and Human Services side, there's some one-time nature of some spending reductions.
But Dr. Columbakidis could help us understand more of that finer detail, so I wait with that question for her.
I think this would, Senator, I think Budget Director Mingy will probably cover this section.
But for
Senator Giffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. For today, Commissioner, and all due respect to you, I want to ask some questions, but I don't want to ask you of them when you have staff who know more details. I get that. I understand that. So is that going to happen today yet,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. Well, okay.
Yeah, okay, good. Then I'll wait. Thank you.
And good question, Senator Kiffmeyer. Commissioner, would you like to go into that revenue change that we experienced, or would you like the Director Mingy to go into that?
I'm sorry, in the
revenue? The revenue change amount of $322 million.
Oh,
you did not mention the amount, I believe.
I didn't.
No.
Chair Rosen, I can go into it. I think Dr. Columbakidis probably has the best view of the HITS model and really what happened there. But the short version, Chair and members, is that there was essentially an overspecification of a few of the sample tax returns that are used. That modeling error, that coding error, basically overrepresented and overweighted that portion of the sample. And so as you push that number forward and as we use that model going forward, it resulted in an overestimation of income. Dr. Columbakidis can talk about it some more, but in all, it was about $92 million in the current biennium, about $270 million in the tails. And the issue here is that it's a great partnership, frankly, between House Research, Department of Revenue, and MMB. And together, we're using sort of one source of truth, a model that's created and specified that really creates a simulation that all of us use for really complex interactions of what's the estimates of revenue and income. The revenue estimates are what the taxes look like from the Department of Revenue and our experts over there, and our economists at MMB who really look at the growth factors and figure it out. So we all work together on that same model. It turned up after the forecast that that model had a specification in there that was an error, and that was what was used in putting together our numbers.
So, Commissioner, on the slide that is up, the 9.253, what is it now? What's the actual number now? Now, although you are going to be using 9.253, is that
right.
Correct? But for our sake, what is the real number?
Chair, I would still use this number as our forecast. This is our forecast. We're not changing that estimate. I'm telling you that there are going to be ups and downs and things that even in this presentation today, you'd say, that could have an impact if oil prices have gone up by more than $10 a barrel. You know, what would that happen to? Well, how would that affect gas prices? That would be a negative. We tend to sort of sometimes overestimate or overvalue that latest piece of information. So the practice has been once the forecast is released, that is the forecast. But we're going to keep giving you information like this so you have a sense as session rolls on of whether we were right on, a little optimistic, a little pessimistic. Another key piece of information you're going to get on a monthly basis, in fact, in just a couple of days, is the monthly revenue numbers. We're going to see if those track our estimates as well. So I hesitate to say take money off of the forecast, simply because then we're going to be chasing a number constantly. And that hasn't been our practice in the past, and I think it simplifies, frankly, the budgeting process. But I do want to make sure in all transparency that you know what are the risks, what are the things that we see so that you see them too.
And Commissioner, I'm not sure if I didn't hear it, but what side of the revenue was underestimated or overestimated, I should say. Was it the income? It was income.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think we discussed this when you called, when we talked this weekend, and I asked how are we going to be able to make sure that in the future, because with $9 billion, is $300 million or over $300 million going to make that big of a difference? No, it's not. But if you only have $100 million surplus, $32 million could be a big adjustment in going forward. So what internally have you talked about how this can mitigate this issue again going forward?
Yeah, Chair Rosen, excellent question. And at the time I was like, I'm not quite sure. I think there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is certainly just continuing to recognize the partnership between our organizations on this so that we have talented individuals working on this, clearly sharing information. That was the case. That's why we were able to find this information, and I appreciate that partnership. Two is, I think, you know, one of the past practices has been of holding that income tax model and that information until the day of the forecast. As you know, Chair, you know, some parts of the forecast have conversations between nonpartisan fiscal staff and the executive branch prior to the forecast release, so that there's sort of a conversation on invalidating some of those assumptions. We're going to be talking about whether that practice, the current practice, really serves us best, or whether there's some things or ways that we might be able to talk about the model better prior to the forecast release. So there, those are a couple of things that at least we're going to investigate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, you mentioned it, and maybe I didn't hear it correctly, but maybe Madam Chair and Commissioner, I'm suggesting something here with the recent developments worldwide here, and Commissioner, you mentioned that in your previous statement here, and I'm wondering if we shouldn't be maybe updated here on this committee, either weekly, biweekly. I mean, it's really changing, it seems to be. And Commissioner, I think you may have said that you're going to be watching it very close and informing us, because these numbers are really going to probably change with what's going on with our oil prices. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if we should have a report or mm-hmm. maybe get a report from the Commissioner once a week or something. I don't mm-hmm. suggest that. I don't know if it's that volatile or not, but. Mm-hmm.
Commissioner, and I wonder if that's a question for Dr. Kolumbakidis,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Either way. Yeah.
Right. Your thoughts on that, Bill Commissioner?
Chair, Senator, I mean, I think, you know, I wouldn't want to set into kind of a periodic one week every week. I don't know that we're going to be any more useful news source than any of the places you're getting information right now. What I think is useful, and I think Dr. Kolumbakidis will mention, is just that, you know, we do get updated forecasts from our national economic forecasters. So understanding, you know, what they're assuming, how they see this impacting the world economy, and sorting out some of that analysis, I think is a useful input, and we will be getting that to you, I think, quite shortly, and I'm sure she can comment on that. The other thing, I think, you know, is just remember, we have that monthly report that will be coming across.
Right.
And so we'll be able to sort of continue giving you information that way as well.
Right. Okay. Very good. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on what Senator Ingebrigtsen was asking about, too, because of being the error in the forecasting that you notified us of is small potatoes compared to what could happen, what's happening in Europe and Ukraine. But I just wonder, how often does Dr. Kolumbakidis get these forecasts? I know that they're forecasts as well. They don't have any expert insight into this, but it seems to me that the international affairs could have about 10 times the impact of the little glitch in the forecasters, the data you got. How often do you hear from them, and is that going to be useful for, I guess we'll all know, I assume, if it's a huge impact?
Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, if it would be possible, this might be a good transition to Dr. Kolumbakidis' presentation, because that's exactly, I think, some of the things that we want to make sure that the committee hears about the impact, what we know from our national consultants, and how that fits into context.
Thank you, Commissioner. We certainly will. Good morning. Welcome, Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Senators. For the record, I'm Laura Kolumbakidis, Minnesota State Economist. I'll get into my prepared remarks, but let me answer the questions that have been that have come by already. So, Senator Marty's question: we hear from the U.S. macro forecaster IHS monthly. It's typically around the 7th or the 8th of the month. And our normal, this goes to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question two, as the commissioner alluded to, our normal cadence of reporting to you is every month on the 10th of the month, we report on how revenues are coming in relative to our current forecast for that month. So on the 10th of the month, you can expect information from us. And then on a quarterly basis, we put out a larger report on the 10th of the month that includes the revenue update in more detail. So more of the finer detail of the how revenues have been coming in, and more explanation about what we think is going on with revenues. And so that's our opportunity to say, here's the revenue situation, and we think it's because of blank. We think it's a timing issue, or we think it's because the economic conditions are changing. And in those quarterly reports, we also report on how the U.S. economic outlook has changed since the last time we reported it to you. So our next quarterly report will be on our next monthly report of just revenues will be on March 10th. Our next quarterly report will be on April 10th. I don't have a calendar in front of me. If the 10th falls on the weekend, we'll do it on Monday. And so that will tell you what IHS's April outlook said relative to February. IHS gives us a forecast every month. When there are significant changes in that forecast, we can let you know that. I can tell you that they have released their March outlook, and they haven't released all the detail. I don't have all the detail. I just have a summary. And they have lowered real GDP growth for this year by 0.4, 4/10 of a percentage point. So when I get to my GDP chart, you can see how that goes. I don't have their change for CPI, for the consumer price index, or for oil prices, and we don't have that detail yet. But for personal consumption expenditure inflation, they've increased it by 0.5 percentage point for this year. So that information, obviously, I can give you today. When there is a material change to that outlook, we can let you know. Madam Chair, I will jump into my prepared remarks. And as usual, I'll start with the U.S. economic outlook. I'll talk about how that's changed since November, but I've already also just explained how it's changed since February. I'll talk about Minnesota's economy, and then I'll turn to details of the revenue forecast. So the U.S. economy, prior to the couple of weeks ago, or 10, 12 days ago, whatever it is now, has been recovering and continues to recover from the COVID-induced recession, which was just 2 months in the very short recession in the spring of 2020. The U.S. unemployment rate had fallen by December to 3.9%. Total employment had recovered to 97.8% of pre-pandemic employment. And unemployment benefit claims had receded to 2019 levels. So over this time, home values, financial asset values, corporate profits, those all had risen. And the economy, U.S. economy, was forecast to recover to pre-pandemic employment levels this year. And economic growth was forecast to continue. Now, of course, we have significant challenges to this outlook, even prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In the November forecast, we were telling you about the risks from inflation, from supply chain disruptions, from labor force participation, and from the path of the pandemic. And then on top of that, we have the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent sanctions, and we don't even know what the end game is there and how things are going to change day to day, much less week to week, month to month. So that significantly increased uncertainty with regard to this economic forecast. So I'll go to my first chart, and that shows the IHS forecast for annual growth in real GDP. So this is inflation-adjusted GDP. This is the U.S. The gray bars show the November forecast, and the dark bars show the February 22 forecast. IHS in February estimated that U.S. real GDP grew 5.7% last year. That's faster than the 5.5% they assumed in the November outlook. So that's an improvement in the GDP outlook for 21. Relative to November. In addition, of course, we had the winter wave of Omicron, which slowed consumer spending on services, and that dampened consumer spending at the beginning of this year, and so that helped to bring down expectations for growth this year to that 3.7%. As I said today, I've got the March outlook by IHS, which has 3.3% growth for 22. So that's that. There's that 0.4 percentage point I was talking about. And that is down from 4.3% in November. In 23, IHS had 2.7% for in their February outlook, down from the 2.9% in November. As of their March outlook, that is now at 2.8%. So they brought up the outlook for 23. And then the forecast for 24 and 25, as of the February forecast, are about 0.1 percentage point lower than they had been in November. This kind of gives you an idea, incidentally, of how things change month to month. Generally, we have these relatively small incremental changes month to month, and the changes can be different in the near term versus the far term. So it just shows how the goalpost keeps moving as these forecasts get adjusted. Now, while we have a lower forecast for calendar year 22 in real GDP, the forecast for some underlying important economic variables have been raised since November. Forecasts for nominal consumer spending, so that's consumer spending that includes inflation, wage and salary income, and corporate profits, these are all things that more directly influence tax revenues, and they do include inflation. Those are all higher than November. So let's talk about inflation in the next chart.
Dr. Kalambakidis, before you leave that chart, we have a few questions for you. Senator Pratt. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kalambakidis, as we've been talking about the decline in GDP growth for 22, I'm wondering, are we seeing any changes in the out years? And also, is there any talk or forecast of likelihood of a double dip recession?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, so I'll read for you the real GDP growth rates that IHS is saying in their March outlook. So they have 3.3% for 22. So that's down from what we had in February. Mm-hmm. They have 2.8% in 23. So that's up 0.1 percentage point from February. 2.8% in 24. So that's up from what we had in February. And 2.8% in 25. So the pattern is that they have lower growth in the current year and a little bit higher growth in the later years. So sort of pulled some growth out of the current years and put it into the later years. What was the other question? The picture would look very similar to what you're seeing here, except that 22 would be, that blue bar would be lower at 3.3%. So as long as the real GDP bars are above the horizon, as long as they're positive, that means there is no recession. Okay, so a recession would bring real GDP, like you see for 20, calendar year 20, would bring it below the horizon to negative. So what we have is not declining real GDP, we have slowing real GDP growth, a deceleration of GDP, but it continues to grow. So the very short answer to that is no, there is no recession in this outlook, either in February or in March.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think my concern here is as we saw in 21, we expected inflation to be transitory and it increased dramatically and quickly. My fear is that as we've seen this real GDP forecast drop 1 percentage point over the last 2 months, 3 months, that we might see the same phenomena in 22 on the growth side. And that's why I asked about the potential for a recession. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Dr. Kalambakidis too. Would you talk a little bit about the GDP? back in the day, I remember something about it being private. You know, part of it's going to be measuring the private activity, and then part of it's going to be the government activity. And when we're looking at this and the drop that you see, would you talk, is there a significant drop in government spending on that, or is it private activity that we're seeing, or could you explain that a little bit clearer to me?
Dr. Kalimbakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, great question. GDP is made up of consumer spending, business investment, government activities, net exports. And it's not government spending on transfer payments, it's government consumption and government investment. Two-thirds of GDP is consumer spending. So as the consumers go, so goes GDP, and so goes the economy. And about 17% is business investment, most of the rest is government. So in the change from November to February, I think the largest changes were in consumer spending and business investment. IHS does adjust for any changes in government spending, but I think the big changes in government spending had already occurred by November. Now, if you're talking about how things have changed in their March outlook, which we just received, I can't answer that. I don't have the details.
Senator Johnson.
Oh, that's helpful. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Okay. No further questions. Please continue, Dr. Kalimbakidis.
Sure. Okay, so I was talking about some of the things that, some of the nominal things that changed, and so we were going to talk about inflation, which, of course, we've already been talking about, and it was the story even before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We knew that would be an important story, an important part of this forecast. It became more salient in November and then even more salient in February. So price inflation, as has already been pointed out by the senators, exceeded expectations in 21 last year. And that happened as demand recovered faster than some of the capacity-constrained sectors in the U.S. economy were able to match with regard to supply. In December of 21, the consumer price index rose 7.1% over December of 20. So you all remember that December number of 7.1. That was 12 months apart, so December 21 over December of 20. So that end-of-year spike in inflation in 21 brought annual inflation to 4.7%, which you see in this chart. And that's the highest annual reading since 1990, and it's above IHS's November forecast of 4.5%. Then you'll also remember that in January, that 12-month apart number was 7.5% inflation. So the increase in inflation continued into this year. And then higher and more widespread inflation in 21 raised expectations for price increases this year. For 22, as of their February outlook, IHS forecast 4.5% inflation compared to 3.3% in November. So the chart that I'm showing you here is obviously November compared to February forecast, percent change in the consumer price index. And I do not have in front of me the percent change in consumer price index for the March outlook. However, they have revised upward, IHS has revised upward their forecast for personal consumption expenditure, the personal consumption expenditure index, which is another way to measure inflation. And that they've raised by 0.5 percentage point for this year. So you could expect that in this chart, the blue bar for 22 would be a little higher if we had the March outlook in here. Now, what the IHS was saying at the time of the February outlook, and they're still saying most of these things, they expect inflation to be eased by the gradual resolution of supply chain issues. In particular, they write about they do expect the supply chain issue regarding microchips. They're watching that carefully, and they're seeing that getting resolved. So they do expect these supply chain issues to be resolved in general. And they expect rising labor force participation, people coming in back into the labor force, and that relieving some pressure on wages, which can relieve some pressure on prices. They lowered their outlook for labor force participation from November to February. So they did not have a particularly, an overly exuberant forecast for labor force participation in their February outlook. But nevertheless, they did expect some of that to improve. And then importantly, their outlook for inflation is influenced by what they think we think about what the Fed is going to do and what the Fed can do. And so they're looking at where households and businesses have their expectations anchored with regard to inflation. And their reading of that is that people do expect the Fed to be able to control inflation. And that's part of the reason that they have their outlook falling, their inflation outlook falling into the 2% range here in 23 and beyond. However, this February outlook, as you know, was prepared early in February and did not reflect the risks to energy prices, agricultural commodity prices, overall price inflation, financial market volatility, all of those things arising from Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the related sanctions against Russia. Of course, oil prices have already well exceeded what IHS had forecast for the first quarter of 22 in their February outlook. And I do not have details about what they are forecasting for oil prices now.
Dr.
So related to inflation, oh, sure.
I was just going to ask, what is the federal policy that's going to level off this inflation? What are they suggesting?
So, Madam Chair, so regarding the Federal Reserve?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at the time of the February outlook, IHS expected the Fed to begin acting to raise their policy interest rate, which is the federal funds rate, at their March meeting. And the Fed, since IHS released that outlook, their February outlook, the Chair Powell has said, yes, that is what we're going to do. We're going to raise the federal funds rate 25 basis points at our March meeting. So that's consistent. That's still consistent with what IHS expected. And then in their February outlook, IHS, I believe, had three more rate increases this year. So that's the Fed policy that IHS was expecting to happen and that they expected would bring this inflation down. Just looking at their, they now, in their as of their March outlook, they are saying that they have pulled one more rate increase into 22. Oh. So a rate increase that they previously thought might occur in 23, they now think it's going to happen in 22. So they have five rate increases in 23. So when we get the dust begins to settle on their March outlook, the story is they've lowered growth this year, they've increased inflation this year and for a couple of years going forward, and they've increased interest rates higher than what they had in their February outlook.
Thank you, Dr. Kalambakidis. A quick question, how many monitors do you have there? It's probably like you're like a air traffic controller. You got a lot going on over there. Senator Johnson.
Well, it's government work. I've just got two monitors.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just another question, too. On inflation relative, U.S. inflation relative globally, are we seeing any advantage, or are we lower interest inflationary rates here at the U.S.? What are you seeing on the global perspective?
Dr.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Kalambakidis.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator, fascinating question. I don't have any recurrent information, like very recent information on that, but generally we have lower inflation than in, say, European countries. Some of that has to do with having lower energy prices. But I don't wanna overstate my knowledge about that.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I'm asking that, I'm just wondering about, you know, private investment globally. Is that still going to be remain strong in the U.S. relative to other countries? Are we going to be seeing some of that influx into the U.S., maybe a positive balanced trade or something that way mm-hmm. as well? Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if it's even relevant or not, but does the U.S., do you differentiate within the U.S. between states on inflation too? Are there, you know, some reason inflationary effects that hit Minnesota harder than it might, say, California or Texas or something like that as well?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, let me address your first point. Mm-hmm. First, I'm not sure if you had asked another question, but let me just add to that. So you asked about the differential between U.S. inflation and inflation elsewhere. And then you were talking about investment here. So another important differential is the differential in rates of return on investment in the United States versus other places. And the United States, so when there is a flight to safety, so you can think of a flight to safety in investment as being the kind of thing that may be happening in the stock market right now and is causing some of the volatility in the stock market right now, which is, I had my money in the stock market, that looks riskier right now, I'm going to try to put my money in something that's safer. The U.S. tends to benefit in terms of investment from a flight to safety because U.S. treasuries are considered like the baseline safe investment, and because the rates of return in the U.S. stock market can tend to be more certain than in other places. And so this is part of the inability to foresee what all is going to happen economically as the war continues and evolves, is that a flight to safety is one of the things that actually could increase investment in the United States and could raise rates of return here and could affect interest rates here. So I'll just leave that there. That can be a action reaction that happens in the U.S. economy. And then state by state inflation. We don't have a Minnesota specific inflation measure or forecast, but generally you're going to see differentials in inflation across states when transportation is a big issue. For instance, you're far away from the places where consumer goods are made or food is made and energy costs vary a lot across states because of climate in transportation. And then housing is one of the big factors in consumer price inflation. So in places where housing is more expensive, you're going to see higher general inflation. Minnesota has higher housing prices now than we did in the recent past. So our both rents and home prices are increasing. And so they're higher relative to what they were in the recent past, but they're still lower than what they are in some of the other large coastal areas, for instance.
John? Okay. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kolumbakidis, I want to thank you. This has been a really great discussion. In the second sentence of this text box, you went through supply chain issues pretty closely and obviously in monetary policy. I was really interested if you could talk a little bit more about consumer demand reverting to services, sort of where we've been and where we're headed.
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Kent, during the pandemic, consumers shifted their spending away from the face-to-face services that were affected by economic restrictions toward goods in particular, goods in general, but durable goods in particular. This was not foreseen, and so it's one of the reasons that the sales tax forecast, for instance, was higher in calendar year 20 and 21 during the pandemic than what we expected, because consumers had money. Most people didn't lose their jobs, and lots of people got stimulus payments. And so they found ways to spend that money. That reversed a long trend where consumers were moving away from goods towards services. So for a decades-long trend, U.S. consumers have spent more of their money on services and less on goods. We've become a service economy that has to do with technology, for instance, so technical services. So in the pandemic, that reversed. So that long trend reversed. And we started to spend more on consumer goods, especially durable goods, things having to do with furniture, athletic equipment, appliances, all of those kinds of things. So that pushed up price inflation on those goods. And those goods became very supply constrained. As you know, if anybody who's tried to order any of those consumer durable goods, a refrigerator or a couch or lumber, those things were supply constrained, and so those prices went up. So what IHS is expecting in their outlook is that consumers are reverting now that economic restrictions are less and people can turn back to those face-to-face services. They're going to relieve some of the price pressure on those durable goods, those things that are also affected by supply chain, and shift their dollars to services. And that shift back to a more normal pattern, which is what IHS expects, back to this more normal pattern, that is going to bring down pressure on prices in general. Because it's basically shifting consumer dollars away from supply-constrained sectors to less supply-constrained sectors.
Senator Kent? Good. Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question I have in regards to inflation, doing a little research and going backwards on the gas prices in particular, that this started last year. So gas prices didn't all of a sudden go up this year. We hear about it somewhat. The effect of it tends to do that. But this was very apparent already last year that gas prices were going up. And so my expectation then, because this is so much forecasting, is that the November forecast and this February forecast would be including those gas price increases, because it started last year. There was forecast, and we all understand Ukraine added through another little extra thing in here. But these gas prices were already going up already due to the canceling of the Keystone pipeline and just some other things that were going on. But that happened last year. So Dr. Colombo-Kitas, can you talk about what you included, how you handled gas price increases in the November forecast, and then now in this February one?
Dr. Colombo-Kitas.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, as of the November outlook, the November forecast, all of the history, the current and recent history of gas prices had been included. And IHS, as of their November outlook, I'm looking at a comparison of November to February, they had expected, I'm looking at the average price of Brent crude oil, they had expected that to begin coming down some, but stay elevated at around an average of under $80, around $75 a barrel or so in their outlook. That was November. By February, gas prices had increased more. So all of the last year growth in, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say gas prices, I should say oil prices. I'm talking about the Brent crude oil price. As of the November outlook, all of the increase in oil prices that had occurred up to that point was incorporated into their November outlook. Any increase in the Brent crude oil price that occurred between November and the beginning of February was incorporated in the February outlook. So the price of Brent crude oil in the February outlook is higher than it was in the November outlook. In their February outlook, they expected the price of oil to peak this quarter, first quarter of this year, and then to come down and get back in the vicinity of by 24, it looks like around $70 a barrel. So now the price of oil is higher, as I think I mentioned before, is higher right now than what IHS expected for this quarter on average. And what they had before was a peak in this quarter. So surely, when I get the information from the March outlook, it will show that the price of Brent crude oil has peaked higher than what they had forecast in February.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's very important for us to know that those original price increases in 2021 were already in the November forecast, and then the increase from there went into the February forecast. That,
that's right.
That floor for us, that per barrel oil and the impact that that has, that was important for me to understand that that was in the November and the February. So I appreciate that information very much.
Interesting. Okay. Okay, no further questions. Please continue.
All right. So I think I'm done talking about inflation unless there are more questions. We can move to the next chart, which shows one of the other variables that increased, that has a higher forecast in February versus November and influenced our income tax forecast. So again, this is still U.S. variables, but we do use the U.S. economic outlook plus Minnesota-specific data to forecast Minnesota. So this chart, the height of the bars shows annual growth in U.S. total wage and salary income. So to be clear, this value is the sum of all of the payrolls of all of the employers in the United States, and the height of the bars in each case shows how fast that value is growing. So this value, total wage and salary income, or total wage and salary disbursements, so think of it as total payroll. This total payroll can grow if more people are working and they're all making the same amount of money they were before, or if the same number of people are working and people are making more money per worker, or if both of those things are happening. So if you have more people working and if average wages are going up, both of those things are happening in this outlook, both more workers and average wages going up. So I just want to be clear on that, because it's easy to look at the numbers I have here and compare them to inflation and think that you are comparing wages to inflation, and it's not, because this is more people working as well influences this. So IHS does expect, and they continue to expect this, the tightening U.S. labor market, meaning low unemployment and high demand for workers, to drive up wage and salary income. They estimate that wage income grew 9.1% last year, so that's quite a bit above the 8% that they had forecast in November. And then they estimated an acceleration to 9.4% for this year. That's up from 7.9% in their previous outlook. Then they expect this deceleration. Remember, we're seeing a deceleration pattern in all of these charts, that as economic growth decelerates or slows down, so does inflation and so does wage and salary income. So they expect a deceleration down into the fours and fives for subsequent years. And those are, in their February outlook, those numbers are about 3/10 of a percentage point on average lower than what we had in the November outlook. This this chart, as I said, is not the chart you would look at to ask answer the question, have wages been keeping up with inflation? But we do have a chart in our book. So Commissioner gave a pitch for the book. And I don't have the page number in front of me. I just remember it. No, I guess not. But we do have a chart in our forecast book that does compare the inflation rate to the employment cost index, which is a fair comparison. And I can't find it at the moment, but the bottom line of that is that up to now, the growth in inflation over the last half a year or year has been higher than the growth in the employment cost index, which is, it's the wage-only employment cost index, which is a measure of wage inflation or how much wages are growing. Up until recently, inflation has outpaced that wage increase measure. But as of their November outlook, IHS was expecting that to flip in the coming year, that this year and next, that's going to flip so that wage growth will outpace inflation after that point. I see there are some hands up. Should I stop?
Yes, Dr. Kalambakidis. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kalambakidis, question I have here is, what's been included in this, in particular unemployment insurance? We've got a big, big increase. I think, is it today, tomorrow? There's current statute that requires, that's going to take a lot of money out of our businesses just to feed back money into the unemployment insurance pool here to pay back the feds for the money we borrowed there. That's going to take a big chunk of money out of businesses. And that means they're not going to have that money available for hiring employees, giving salary increases, expending money on buying additional equipment or expanding. It's just going to take money out of those small businesses and corporations equally. They're all going to have to contribute into this. Have you factored that into this U.S. wage and salary? Now, I know this is U.S. wage, but for Minnesota, because other states have used the federal money, as we're allowed to do, as we have proposed, Chair Rosen, to do that. And so other states have taken that away so that the businesses then are able to have that growth, have that wage increases, have those salary, do things like that. In Minnesota, we have not done that. So, Dr. Kalambakidis, how has that been factored into this, both the November and the February forecast?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm happy to answer that question. I just want to let you know that the chart I was looking for with the Employment Cost Index is on page 21 of our full book.
Okay.
So you can look for that if you would like. So in the U.S. outlook here, which is what you have here, IHS, as of November, we asked them about this, about what were they doing with regard to states that had increases in unemployment insurance taxes coming up. And they said that they knew that that was happening, that was is generally considered in the outlook, but they hadn't done any state-by-state analyses yet. So that's the same case here, is that they knew it was happening. It hasn't had a state-by-state impact. But we do Minnesota's employment and wage forecast, and we knew that this was something that was on the books. And so we do assume that businesses are going to have to adjust, but we didn't make a specific assumption about how they would adjust, whether they would do that by adjusting profits, wages, employment. And so it has an effect on general business income, but we weren't specific about how that adjustment takes place.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Kalambakidis. I'm kind of surprised at that, actually, especially here in Minnesota, because just on principle, you just know that if you take money out of a business, they don't have it to do the things that businesses can do, which is raise salaries, expand, buy equipment, and all of those things generate revenue to the state of Minnesota. So when that's not included for us in the state, I'm kind of surprised that that would be the case. I think in regards to that, sometimes some of these profits as well, people don't understand that, especially in small businesses, profits are the salary increases. Profits are the expansion, or the profits are used to buy that equipment. So this idea that they just kind of float around out there and don't do anything, they have an impact. In every way, that's how the private market works. So what I'm hearing you say then is that anything that's affecting the UI for the state of Minnesota is not included in the November or February forecast.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, let me clarify. I must not have answered that in a very clear way. It is in the forecast. It's just that it's not in the forecast in a way that I can pinpoint a specific impact and put a dollar amount to that on that for you. So it's current law, it's in the forecast. It's not, I don't have a number I can give you.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this is forecasting and you have to make some assumptions and go from that. I'm just was a little disappointed that that's a large dollar amount over many years that drains our businesses out of what they would otherwise use for salary or equipment or expansion or other good things that they do. And so I think for us to realize there is an impact on revenue to the state of Minnesota. There's an impact to us when we don't take care of this UI issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to get back to what Dr. Kolombakidis was talking about with the employment cost index and how that how much is wage growth versus more people working. And I don't have that page 21 in front of me right now, but how does that compare to the employment cost index? Is that basically what wage growth is? I mean, is that interchangeable, what we call wage growth, that number? And I know there's variation, obviously, because some people have had big raises, others have had none. But where is that right now? Since I don't have the chart in front of me, how much was it for 2021, the best estimates we have, even if they're not final?
Senator Marty, Mr. Nauman did forward that page to everyone.
Oh. Okay, I will check. Thank you.
Box. Dr. Kolombakidis?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, yes, it is the measure you would look at to say, here's how wages have grown. There are different categories of the employment cost index. You can do full cost, which would include non-wage benefits. But what we have in our chart is the wage only employment cost index. And this is for the US, not for Minnesota, because there isn't one for Minnesota. There's one for the city level ones, but not state ones, I think. So yes, it's how much wages have grown. The chart, it looks like it's quarterly data and I don't have values on it. So I don't have an annual number for that, but we can get back to you on an annual number for the percentage change in the U.S. employment cost index in 2021.
Senator
Thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Nauman, for forwarding that page. So it does look like for the next year or two, it looks significant improvement, assuming inflation comes down and the growth rate stays up. It looks like good news that wages would be gaining on it, though it wasn't for a year and a half in there during inflation. Yeah, that's very helpful. I appreciate that chart. I guess that's what I was looking for. So thank you.
And on that question, Dr. Kolombakidis, what are the labor sectors that are seeing that wage growth? The fastest wage growth, I should say.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, senators, members of the committee, the growth has been pretty broad-based, but there has been substantial wage growth at the lower end of the wage spectrum in those service sectors that were hit so hard by the pandemic. So these are sectors that continue to have trouble adding workers. We have the supply problem, the labor supply problem. And so they have had to raise wages in order to attract workers into those jobs. So think about restaurants and entertainment venues and bars. Those are places that lost workers during the pandemic. Many of those workers found something else to do. Got a better job, a different job, a higher paying job, a job that maybe they see as safer. And now those employers are having to restructure the jobs, change the safety profiles in the jobs, and raise wages in order to attract people.
Thank you. And the slowest wage growth, do you have an idea?
I don't have that.
Okay.
That.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to kind of come back to Senator Marty's question as I understand this chart. So this is total wages being paid. This is not the average wage. So we're seeing large increases potentially because we had such high unemployment were rebounding replacing jobs that were lost, not creating new jobs. And in fact, if I recall, our workforce is about 100,000 people shy of where it was in February of 2020. Am I reading the chart right?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, okay, so to be clear, yes, I think you are reading the chart right. And this is US, not Minnesota. So the 100,000 number, I suspect you're talking Minnesota there, but the story's not too dissimilar. Good point, yes, some large percentage increases here are following the very low growth in 20. And following a recession, you're gonna see higher growth coming out of a recession. And what else did you ask? This is both adding workers and it's increase in wages per worker. And I know what you're asking. You're asking about, are we at pre-pandemic levels of employment? Not yet. The U.S. is forecast in the February forecast, the U.S. was forecast to reach pre-pandemic levels of employment this year, sometime this summer. So that's just that's reaching back to the level that we were pre-pandemic, not having the growth that we would have had otherwise. And Minnesota, in our forecast, is forecast to reach pre-pandemic levels of employment next year.
So even, Madam Chair.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you. So even though, say, for 2021, we see a 9.1% increase in wage and salary disbursements, we saw a 1.7% decrease in real wages on the average salary. So when you factor it, that's what I'm trying to understand. This is not real or nominal at the individual wage level. This is cumulative. And I see you nodding, so I'll just roll into my next concern. And it has to do with what Senator Kipmeyer said. If we see increases in payroll taxes, we'd expect those in most cases to be passed on to the consumer, again, raising inflation and potentially lowering real wages again. Is that a reasonable assumption?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, how the firm treats a payroll tax increase will depend on the firm itself, but more importantly, probably on the sector it's in, and maybe even geographically where it is. So some firms would pass that on to consumers in the form of higher prices. Some firms might pass that back to owners in the form of lower profits or lower earnings for the rate of return for the owners. Some might try to offer lower wages. Another factor, I said it matters what sector you're in, that depends, that affects your ability to push prices forward to consumers or back to owners. But almost every company right now is in this tight labor market environment where labor supply is tight. And so it's unlikely, you know, it's gonna be a hard decision to offer lower wages when you actually are in a position where you have to offer higher wages in order to attract workers.
Senator Pratt.
Madam Chair, I'll just go back. I think the concern that Senator Kipmeyer raised, so many businesses have been hurt, particularly those in the hospitality industry. They just can't afford with the increased cost in the supply chain, with the increased cost of trying to build back lost revenue from 2020 and 2021. I just don't see how these increases, these payroll taxes, can't be passed on to the consumers. Either one, as Dr. Kalambakidis said, through offering below inflation rate increases or two, and thereby depressing real wage growth, or two, passing it on to consumers, which would then exacerbate inflation even further and result in lower wage growth. So I think we're in a position here, at least in the state, to be in a lose-lose situation if we don't do something soon.
Thank you, Dr. Pratt. Thank you, Senator Pratt. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Kalambakidis, as I look at this wage and salary growth, how's Minnesota doing relative to the nation when it comes to wage and salary growth? Because when we look at, for example, our traditional medical assistance match, not the expanded Medicaid population at 90-10 and not the enhanced match that's for the emergency, but when we look at comparative median income or household income, I'm not sure the correct term, how are we doing when it comes to keeping up with this national growth?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, for a long time, Minnesota has had higher average per capita income than the United States as a whole. We're one of the highest, we're one of the higher per capita income states. So we are a high income state. We are a high wage earnings state. That's levels, not growth rates, but to be clear, our median and per capita incomes are higher than the average of the US. How would this chart compare to, this is US, how would it compare for Minnesota? That's on page 35 of our forecast book. And our projected growth rates for this value, which is total wage and salary disbursement, our growth rates are lower than what we have in this outlook, in the US outlook. And the main reason for that is that our employment growth rates are lower. And this is, remember I said, US is expected to reach pre-pandemic employment levels this year and Minnesota lags to next year. So this is a situation that was true even before the pandemic, forget about before the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but before the pandemic, Minnesota had slower employment growth in general than the US, and that's because our labor supply was more constrained than the US. So our labor force growth has been slow because of demographic change, because Minnesota is, because of our population is aging out of the workforce. That's true everywhere, but lots of other faster growing states have had larger influxes of international immigration. And Minnesota has relied on international immigration as a way to increase our labor force growth. And that had been slowing, that had been an important factor. And then from 2020 on, that has been slowing, well, actually prior to 2020. So in 18, 19, 20, that the international immigration has been slowing due to federal policies. So what it means is that Minnesota has this slower labor force growth challenge, and we had that prior to the pandemic, and then the pandemic did not obviously make that better, it made it worse. So this chart, we show growth in this value, but it is lower than in Minnesota than it is in the US because our employment growth is slower.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Dr. Kalambakidis, how does that impact that Medicaid match, which we've traditionally referred to as 50-50?
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer Medicaid questions to the budget director or the commissioner.
Okay, good.
Thank you. And we can wait for that if we get to that, Madam Chair. But I tried to find in the budget book where that Medicaid match changed. To me, it's an indication of how we're doing overall competitively. Are we holding our own when it comes to median household income, et cetera? And so I think that's something we need to tease out as we look at bigger picture economic growth. Thank you, Dr. Kalambakidis and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. to the doctor, can you repeat again what you just said around the demographic changes seem to be affecting our growth, and that's because we had a reliance, it sounds like, on immigration, and that has, kind of been stalled on the federal level, and that's coupled with our aging labor population, where folks are deciding to retire and those sort of things, and we haven't, it seems, done a really good job of backfilling those jobs, even by investing in our local labor force, such as like communities of color and that sort of thing. So am I right about that, or can you correct me? Because I'm trying to get to the answer that you gave to Senator Pratt.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion. Yeah, I think you're right. I think you've gathered this correctly, that international in-migration to Minnesota has been important in recent years for growing our labor force. And another plug for our book, there's a discussion and a chart about this on page 38. That international in-migration is important not just in bringing people here who can work, but that people who are coming here from other countries, whether they're immigrating because they have chosen to come here or because they're refugees, and communities of color also are producing, or their kids are our workforce of the future. And so investing in that population has been an important goal. It's something that we talked about even prior to the pandemic, that as the population, baby boomers, age out of the workforce, we need to invest in the people we do have and the workers we do have for the future, so that we can train, retain, and have the workforce that we need going forward. International in-migration since 2017, so in 18, 19, and 20, has fallen, and that has hurt our overall net population growth numbers. And that is largely something that Minnesota doesn't control, but the federal government controls. What we can control is making Minnesota a place where people want to come and want to start a business and live once they get the chance to come to the United States.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Champion.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, so thank you, Doctor, for that, because I think that's a very important message that I hope that my colleagues are listening to as well. I'm on jobs and economic growth, and that's one of the things that I've been really pushing a whole lot, is trying to have a comprehensive approach to this challenge and where we find ourselves. And if we as Minnesotans want to remain globally competitive, then we have to make the investments in other places or spaces in order to make sure that we are backfilling that labor market. Here's my other question. I also heard Senator Pratt was talking a lot about money being passed along to the consumer or the end user, and then that having some impact on wages. And I think what I heard is that, because we're in a tight labor market, wages will continue to remain high, and that depending on the employer, it doesn't necessarily mean that that money would be passed on that cost, or increased cost would be passed on to the end user, that an employer could decide to take less profits as the way to absorb any costs that they have. Am I hearing that correctly, or I just want to make sure if I'm hearing that wrong, I want to be corrected. Thank you.
Dr. Kalambakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, yeah, I did say that there are three different margins, at least, on which a business owner can act when costs increase. There are lots of margins, actually, because they can shift inputs. They can shift between equipment and workers, but they can, they can pass a cost on to consumers if they're in a market where that's possible, They can try to lower wages if they're in a market where that's possible. They can reduce the rate of return to investors, to business owners.
Very good. Senator Champion.
Yeah. Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
To this point, Dr. Kolumbakidis, I had asked you about a comparison to other states, and you said that Minnesota is suffering because of national immigration policy. Could you help me understand why other states aren't suffering due to national immigration policy? Do we do something differently here?
Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Madam Chair, Senator, so it's overall. So overall, U.S. international immigration is lower, has been lower for since this 2017 number that I've got for Minnesota. So that's true for lots of places. Some states just generally get more international immigration than we do. Some that are, you know, along the southern border, for instance, get more international immigration in general.
And so, Senator Benson. Madam Chair, what I'm hearing, it's nothing specifically that we're doing. It's just the nature of how immigrants are coming to this country, whether legally or illegally. But it feels to me like we're not attracting young people to this state as much as some other states might be. And so I think that's something that we need to pay attention to in our policy. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the indulgence.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to address, because I hear this sometimes, this use of the word profits, like it's just sitting there. The work that happens, I kind of liken it to the family checkbook after you've paid utilities, the mortgage, all the things that you have to do, and you have some money left over at the end of the month. You use that money to go out to eat, buy a refrigerator, washer and dryer, maybe a lawnmower, whatever you want to do. You do things with that. It isn't just sitting there. So it has an effect and a positive impact, and the same thing is true with businesses. Businesses at the end of the year have base expenses, and when they have some leftover, they are able to do other things, expand wages, a whole variety of things that they do. And I think it is working capital that I think is an important phrase for that. It's working capital, whether it's your family budget or a business budget, is working capital, and that is a positive thing for our economy and, in the end, for government revenue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Champion.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll start with, I think Senator Kiffmeyer raises an important point. I think it all boils down to value and what we want to do at the end of the day, right? I recognize that in her analogy of family and sitting around and paying bills and that sort of thing, that you want to have disposable income where you can do other things with. That's true. But I also recognize that if my son's college tuition goes up and other things, that I could make a decision as to how best to address that. And I think our responsible business owners do that as well. But I also just want to make sure that if I'm losing sight of something, I would hope the doctor would correct me. But when Senator Benson asked a question about why are other states not suffering because there's the immigration policies that is affecting all states, and that I did hear her say that we should, it sounds like young people are not coming back. Because that's one of the things that I seek to address this year is how do we continue to recruit and retain our young people, but also other people. I think what ends up being the challenge and the reason why I'm continuing to lift this up, and if the doctor wants to speak to this, is that it's not one versus another. It is that it has to be approached comprehensively. So even if I do things or we do things in order to attract young people who are going off to college and we want them to come back to the great state of Minnesota and use their skills and qualifications to elevate our state in a real way, we also still need to make the investments of people of color and others who are sitting on the sideline. So not one or the other. I think that what I didn't hear the doctor talk to, or maybe she can speak to that, is whether those other states, if she knows, we're making solid investments around training and other career choices and other things to invest in, for lack of a better word, their homegrown talent as well. So I don't know if the doctor knows that and can speak to that, but I think that would be important to point out.
Dr. Kalimbikidis.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, I don't have specific information right now comparing Minnesota to other states regarding investments, workforce investments. Just to reiterate that, every state is facing the aging of the baby boomers, and they're also in this environment now facing a tight labor market, and so they're all looking for ways to attract and retain workers. And so Minnesota needs to do that as well in order to be the place that is chosen.
Right. Senator Champion, are you good?
Okay. I am good, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. And I'll bring my hand down because I don't want to keep my hand up. Thank you.
And Dr. Kalimbikidis, I know, and Commissioner, we're butting up against our time frame, and we have a few more slides, and I want to thank you so much for the indulgence here to have our own state economist at our ready, and our commissioner right here to really delve into some great discussion. Is there a possibility of coming back after on Thursday's hearing? We have just one bill up. That's the Senator Tomasoni's ALS bill. Would it be possible to finish what we haven't completed here on Thursday morning? Dr. Kalimbikidis?
Madam Chair, well, I've got appointments on my calendar in the morning, but I can probably move those. And I would defer to the commissioner and budget director on whether they have time for that,
okay,
or if they're able to.
Madam Chair, we'll make it work.
Would that be okay? Thank you very much. Oh, it's been a wonderful discussion. I really appreciate this. So we couldn't maybe get one more slide in. Dr. Kalimbikidis, if you'd like to do the corporate profits higher than expected.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chair Rosen just told the story. Corporate profits are higher than expected and have been. This chart shows levels of U.S. corporate profits. It's not a growth rate this time. It's dollar values. The dashed line is the November forecast from IHS, and the solid line is their February forecast. So you can see that corporate profits grew unexpectedly fast in 21 and are now projected to stay above the November forecast through our forecast horizon. And that led to higher than expected corporate tax receipts so far in fiscal year 22. And then also, it also led to the increase in our corporate tax forecast.
Wonderful.
You need me to wrap up at this point?
Yes, probably. Thank you, okay. Dr. Kalimbikidis. I really appreciate you and the commissioner and spending some significant time with us this morning. And State Budget Director Mingyi, I'm sorry we didn't get to you, but we'll have that opportunity on Thursday morning. Members, we do have a hearing tomorrow, and we are going to have Senate File 3472, the reinsurance bill, and Senate File 3003 is the Prairie Island bill. And the Thursday, as I mentioned, we will just have Senator Tomasoni's ALS bill and then a completion of the slide deck here with the commissioner and the state economist and our budget director. Are there any questions? Any thoughts? Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.